The following message is from the Daily Chapel at Baptist Bible Seminary in Clark Summit, Pennsylvania. You can visit us on the web at www.bbc.edu.
The whole dispensational pre-tribulational movement has always been a Bible study movement. And even its critics acknowledge that. So we believe if it's taught in the Bible, it doesn't matter how long ago it was realized that it was taught in the Bible, you know, that we go with it. But, as I was saying a moment ago, if you've ever advocated pre-tribulationalism, you're going to have somebody come up and tell you Martin McDonald invented the rapture in 1830, a little Scottish lass in Port Glasgow, Scotland. Or, you know, if the pre-trib rapture is so obvious in the Bible, then why in the world didn't anybody see it until 1830 or somewhere around in there? And so that is a good question. And so we need to look in this first lecture, an overall history of the rapture. And in the next three lectures, I'm going to be dealing with what I call the pre-conflagration view rapture, which is a view that's been around for 500 years, and it's not pre-tribulational. But a lot of people try to pass it off as pre-tribulational. Then I'll deal with Darby's views, when he came to know his views on that. And then I will, on the fourth lecture, deal with like critics like Margaret McDonald view and all of that kind of stuff. So here we go. I'm not used to speaking this early in the morning. It's usually about midnight I get going. So even if pre-Darby rapture statements appear, we need to see how they do or do not match up with what Darby taught. Pre-trib rapture critic William Bell, who was graduated from Dallas Seminary and wrote a dissertation back in the 60s against pre-tribulationalism at New York University. See what happens when you move up north? Formulated four criteria for establishing the validity of a historical citation regarding pre-tribulationalism. If any of his four criteria, he said, are met, then he acknowledges such a reference as, quote, of crucial importance if found, whether by direct statement or clear inference. And here are his four criteria. Number one, any mention that Christ's second coming was to consist of more than one phase separated by an interval of years. Number two, any mention that Christ was to remove the church from the earth before the tribulation period. Three, any reference to the resurrection of the just as being in two stages. Four, any indication that Israel and the church would be clearly distinguished, thus providing some rationale for a renewal of Christians before God again deals with Israel, unquote. So Bell's criteria will be used to evaluate a proposed pre-Darby rapture statement. Now, I threw in the Shepherd of Hermas. I don't think it even comes close as a pre-trib statement. It does have, I've got it listed here for you, and he talks about this vision that he had and about how it talks about the possibility of escaping the tribulation. But beyond that, there's nothing really pre-trib in there. In fact, it seems like he's going through the tribulation and all this kind of stuff. So I was just put it in there to show that I don't think it is pre-trib. Now you move to Irenaeus. Irenaeus wrote, you know, about 180, his book Against Heresies. And he talked about how the church shall be suddenly caught up from this, and he was referring to the tribulation. And this is what he said. And therefore, when in the end the church shall be suddenly caught up from this, it is said there shall be a tribulation such as not been since the beginning, nor shall be. For this is the last contest of the righteous in which, when they overcome, they are crowned with incorruption. So it seems like, this could be any kind of time. He's not talking about before the tribulation. He's talking about probably it's at the end of the tribulation. So that's not really a pre-trib rapture statement, even though Irenaeus is a clear futurist, which you have to be a futurist as opposed to a preterist, historicist, or an idealist to be pre-trib. The early church was clearly that. But the early church did teach Immanency. Ryrie defines immanency as an event that is, quote, impending, hanging over one's head, ready to take place, unquote. An imminent event is one that is already ready to take place. Some have recognized that it is common for anti-Nicene writers to speak of an imminent return of Christ, especially during the first century after the apostles. Patristic scholar Larry Crutchfield argues that the early church fathers believed in what he calls imminent intra-tribulationism. He summarizes the view of pre-tribulational scholars on this issue as follows. Quote, in some, with few exceptions, the premillennial fathers of the early church believed that they were living in the last times. Thus, they looked daily for the Lord's return. Even most of those who looked for Antichrist's appearance prior to the second advent saw that event as occurring suddenly and just as suddenly being followed by the rescue and rapture of the saints by Christ. This belief in the imminent return of Christ within the context of ongoing persecution has prompted us to broadly label the view of the earliest fathers as, he calls them, imminent intra-tribulationists, because they seem to act or speak as if they were already in the tribulation, or they were going through those times of persecution. It should be noted that dispensationalists, he continues, have neither said that the early church was clearly pre-tribulational, nor that they are even clear individual statements of pre-tribulationalism in the fathers. As Walbridge says, the historical fact is that the early church fathers' view on prophecy did not correspond to what is advanced by pre-tribulationalists today, except from the one important point that both subscribe to the imminence of the rapture. This view of the fathers on imminency and in some of the references to escaping the time of tribulation constitute what may be termed, to borrow a phrase from Millard Erickson, seeds from which the doctrine of pre-tribulationalism could be developed. In other words, their futurism, their futurist approach to prophecy that is best, I think, represented by Irenaeus, and this view of imminency, if time had gone on, they would have realized that they were not in the tribulation or on the verge of the tribulation, and it might have developed into pre-tribulationalism. Had it not been for the drought brought by Alexandrian allegorism, and later by Augustine, one wonders what kind of crop these seeds might have yielded before Darby in the 19th century. In other words, where it would have gone if it hadn't been cut short by these factors. In fact, if you were to take the early fathers, the anti-Nicene fathers, and all of them who came from Western Turkey were all millennialists, the anti-millennialism all came out of North Africa. What was in North Africa? Alexandria, which was the center of shifted of Greek thought from Athens to Alexandria, Egypt. And so it's not surprising that that would be the place where anti-premillennialism and anti-literalism developed. But where the Apostle John was, and Papias, who supposedly had been discipled by Paul and John, who is considered the father of premillennialism according to Eusebius, and Irenaeus and all these other people, Polycarp, etc., is discipled by John, who discipled Irenaeus, their premillennialism was held by everybody that we have extant writings from. And so you can see that this Alexandrian allegorism, eventually dominated with Jerome and Augustine by the 400s. Historian Kurt Allen also sees the early church imminent expectation of the large return up until the middle of the second century and even later. Christians did not live in and for the present, but they lived in and for the future. And this was in such a way that the future flowed into the present, that future and present became one, a future which obviously stood under the large presence. It was the confident expectation of the first generations that the end of the world was not only near, but that it had already come. It was the definite conviction not only of Paul, but of all Christians of that time, that they themselves would experience the return of the Lord. and Allen sees a decline of true immanence that began around 150, A.D. 150. And he says, as soon as the thought of a postponement of the parousia was uttered once and intended, and indeed not only incidentally but thoroughly presented in an entire writing, it developed its own life and power. At first, people looked at it as only a brief postponement, as the Shepherd of Hermas clearly expresses. But soon as the end of the world did not occur, it was conceived of as a longer and longer period until finally his is today the situation, nothing but the thought of a postponement exists in people's consciousness. You know, I mean, that's true. People, even in Christianity, talk as if Christ will never come again, as if we're going to go on and on and on. And hardly any longer is there the thought of the possibility of an imminent parousia. Now, Alan's a liberal German over in Germany. He's not exposed to us weird Americans. Today, we live with the presumption, I would say, from the presumption that this world is going to continue. It dominates our consciousness. Practically, we no longer speak about a postponement, but only seldom does the idea of the end of the world and the large return for judgment ever occur to us. Rather, it is pushed aside as annoying and disturbing in contrast to the times when faith was alive. It was very characteristic that in ages when the church flourishes, the expectation of the end revives. We think of Luther. We think of pietism. There was a German pietism. If we judge our present time by its expectation of the future, unquote. Post-tribulationists like J. Parton Payne also admit that the early fathers held to an immanency viewpoint. Of course, he was a historicist post-millennialist. There's very few of those guys around. And he died in the 70s. It must therefore be concluded that the denial of the imminence of the Lord's coming on the part of post-tribulationalists who have reacted against dispensationalism is not legitimate. Belief in the imminency of the return of Jesus was the uniform hope of the early church, and it was only with the rise of the detailed application of Bible prophecy at the close of the second century to yet future history that its truth was questioned. And in fact, Walbert, if you've ever read his writings, makes a big deal out of the fact that all forms of post-tribulationalism today, if you were to systematically analyze them, were forms that were developed after pre-tribulationalism developed. So the different types of post-tribulationalism that people advocate today in books was developed in response to pre-tribulationalism, and they're actually older. You know, when people say they're a historic premillennialist, a lot of people like to say that. I always like to say, so you're a historicist premillennialist. Well, nobody is a historicist except Jehovah's Witnesses and the Wacko and Waco, you know. But nevertheless, they're really not historical premillennialists because they don't really believe what the early church believed. It's a form of post-tribulationalism or premillennialism that was developed after, the last 200 years. So the first find that we have is Pseudo-Ephraim. And this was a discovery that Grant Jeffrey, a Canadian prophecy guy, came up with. He called me up in, I think it was the early 90s, at my office when I was in Washington, D.C., and read me this statement. And it's very pre-trib. So I did research at Catholic University, and Tim Demme and I wrote an article that was published in BibSac talking about the Pseudo-Ephraim thing. And it's a sermon that was preached, we think it was pseudonymical by Pseudo-Ephraim, entitled On the Last Times, the Antichrist, the End of the World, or a Sermon on the End of the World. By the way, it's on our website, pre-trib.org. You know, the entire sermon. We had it translated from Latin. It's about 1,500 words in Latin. And it has some variant readings in Greek and all of this, Syriac. Probably it was originally written in Greek, translated into Syriac, and then into Latin. You know, that's my opinion after reading all of these articles and stuff about that particular sermon. Concerning the timing of the rapture, it says we ought, so it, a lot of people place it at 373 AD, 373. And here's the rapture statement, and this is in the second paragraph of 10 paragraphs. And in the ninth and tenth paragraph, it talks about the second coming. In the middle paragraphs between the second and the ninth and tenth, it talks about the tribulation. It says, we ought to understand thoroughly, therefore, my brethren, what is imminent or overhanging. Why, therefore, do we not reject every care of earthly actions and prepare ourselves for the meeting of the Lord Jesus Christ, so that he may draw us from the confusion? Confusion is a term he uses for to describe the tribulation throughout his sermon, which overwhelms all the world. For all the saints and elect of God are gathered before, together before the tribulation which is to come, and are taken to meet the Lord, in order that they may not see at any time the confusion which overwhelms the world because of our sins. So this meets three of Dr. Bell's criteria for a preacher of rapture statement, because he clearly talks about how we'll be, the elect are gathered in the Greek variant that's synagoge. And by the way, if you read much early church eschatology, 2 Thessalonians is probably the dominant passage in early church eschatology, which of course episynagoge is found in 2 Thessalonians 2. And before the tribulation, which is to come, and are taken to the Lord. And he goes on and describes the horrors of the tribulation. And this was written about in a book published posthumously by a guy named Abramson, who was a classics professor at Cal Berkeley, hardly a dispensational stronghold. And Paul J. Alexander, I'm sorry. And it's published by University of California Press at Berkeley. And he thought it was a preacher of rapture. He contrasts it to, and he was probably Greek Orthodox. And I've read everything he's written that I, except for his article in Russian. I didn't read that. And he's very likely Greek Orthodox. And he had this novel view about Byzantine culture. He said, you know, since the Byzantines were so into religion, maybe we ought to study the religious aspects to help us understand Byzantine culture. Wow, what a breakthrough. And so he did a lot of work in eschatology and apocalypticism because it was big. By the way, there's never been a time in the history of the church when the church hasn't been interested in eschatology. You know, there's been times when they're more interested, but they've always been interested. They just have different types of eschatology down through church history. So Pseudo-Ephraim presents at least three important features found in the modern preacher revelation. One, there are two distinct comings, the return of Christ to rapture the saints, followed by Christ's second advent to the earth. Number two, a defined interval between the two comings. In this case, 3.5 years. And you'll find almost all of these people believe the tribulation was 3.5 years. And so it's not mid-trib, because mid-trib would be 1.75 years, because they believe the entire length of the tribulation was 3.5 years. So three is clear statement that Christ will remove the church from the world before the tribulation. The fact that Pseudo-Ephraim placed the rapture, okay. Even Darby originally believed that the rapture would occur 3.5 years before the second coming until 1845. Pseudo-Ephraim's pre-tribulationism was formulated and preached as early as 373. And post-trib scholar Bob Gundry, by the way, he wrote me a letter a number of years ago saying that our Pseudo-Ephraim find had motivated him to write a new book. And he wrote his book that came out in the 90s called First the Antichrist with Baker. And he had a 23-page attempted rebuttal of the pseudo-Ephraim find in there. And he basically tried to argue that the word gathered there was an evangelistic term, not a eschatological term. And he assumed that Ephraim, the Syriac, who's the most influential Syriac Christian in the early church, that he was pseudo-Ephraim, which I disagree with, but nevertheless, he showed that Ephraim uses the term gathered like 12 times for evangelism. The only problem is, this is clearly an eschatological context of pseudo-Ephraim, and he's not talking about evangelism. And so, you know, you can sit here and show all these other verses or passages where Ephraim taught something, but we're talking about eschatological context, and these Ephraim is probably not pseudo-Ephraim, and secondly, these were not eschatological contexts in which he was talking about. And also, Paul Alexander, the Byzantine scholar, who had this quote from which we traced down his entire sermon from, he took it as a preacher of rapture statement. So, I think that pseudo-Ephraim is a legitimate preacher of rapture statement. You know, it's possible that pseudo-Ephraim even could have been Amil. We're not saying he was a dispensationalist or anything, but he has a two-event separated by the tribulation view of that. He certainly wasn't a dispensationalist. And by the way, I would argue that the ingredient missing throughout church history until the 1800s is not necessarily the preacher of rapture from dispensationalism. It's the distinction between Israel and the church. That was the breakthrough that Darby came up with, which is an ecclesiastical issue. Then we have Brother Dalcino, and this article, this was discovered by Gumerlach, who is a post-millennial preterist. And he's friends with Gary DeMar, and he's co-written a book with Gary DeMar. And so he's no friend of dispensationalism, is all I'm saying. And he's a classic scholar with a PhD from St. Louis University, or University of St. Louis, or whatever it is. And he has gone through and read those 500 volumes of Greek and Latin, you know, that have never been translated into English. You know, you think you're getting with those three set volumes, all the church fathers, you're not. There's a good 500 volumes that have never been translated into English, by the way. And so he went through all of that and studied all the eschatological passages. He sent an email to Mark Hitchcock and me and said that he has three drawers full, I think filing drawers full, of pre-trib rapture statements from the Middle Ages. Now, I don't know what that means, and he says that when he gets around to it, he's going to write a book, you know, bringing those to light. So, once again, he's not a big pre-trib fan. And so the apostolic brethren were a movement, you know, coming out of Joachim de Fiori's overall eschatological movement from the 1200s in northern Italy, and it was started by Gerard Sagarello, around who died in 1300. And this came out of the Franciscan order, and when he died, Brother Dalcino was number two, and he took over leadership of the movement in 1300. And they were in northern Italy, living up in the mountains and everything. That's where all the anti-Catholics went to live in those days, in the Alps. And he died. Brother Dalcino was killed in 1307 when their numbers got too big, and in the thousands, and the Pope sent armies up and they liquidated them. And in 1316, an anonymous notary of the Diocese of Vercelli in northern Italy wrote a brief treatise in Latin that set forth the deeds and beliefs of the apostolic brethren. And the treatise was called The History of Brother Dalcino. And At one point in the treatise, the Apostolic Brethren, the following paragraph appears. Again, Dolcino believed and preached and taught that within those 3 years, Dolcino himself and his followers will preach the coming of the Antichrist, and that the Antichrist was coming into the world within the bounds of the said 3.5 years. And after he had come, then he, Dolcino and his followers, would be transferred into paradise, in which are Enoch and Elijah. So he's talking about a translation like Enoch and Elijah. And in this way, they will be preserved unharmed for the persecution of Antichrist. And then that Enoch and Elijah themselves would descend on the earth for the purpose of preaching against Antichrist. Then they would be killed by him or by his servants, and thus Antichrist would reign for a long time. But when the Antichrist is dead, Dolcino himself, who then would be the Holy Pope, isn't that great? Dolcino gets to be Pope. And his preserved followers will descend on the earth and will preach the right faith of Christ to all, and will convert those who will be living then to the true faith in Jesus Christ. So it's set within a Catholic medieval eschatological viewpoint, but it clearly taught a rapture 3.5 years if you were one of the elect guys, and coming back down to the earth and all of this kind of stuff. So a Gumerlach clearly believes that this is a pre-trib rapture statement. He concluded, and this was published, he originally presented this at ETS, and it was published in BibSac. And it says, this paragraph from the history of Brother Dolcino indicates that in northern Italy in the early 14th century, a teaching very similar to modern pre-tribulationism was preached, responding to distressing political and ecclesiastical conditions. Dolcino engaged in detailed speculations about eschatology and believed that the coming of Antichrist was imminent. He also believed that the means by which God would protect his people from the persecution of the Antichrist would be through a translation of the saints into paradise. In fact, a Jacobus scholar, she's dead now, Marjorie Reeves, also saw a rapture associated with Dolcino. She says of the Apostolic Brethren, quote, they would preach the immediate advent of Antichrist, and when he appeared, Dolcino and his followers would be removed to paradise while Elijah and Enoch descended to combat. When the Antichrist was deposed of, they would descend again to convert all nations, unquote. So the Dolcino statement very well appears to have some form of a two-stage coming, a rapture followed by a time of tribulation, concluding with the prior raptured saints returning to at the second coming. However, such a view falls short of Darby's developed form of a rapture within the dispensational futurist framework. And then we have a guy named Thomas Collier, who died in 1691, a British guy, and he wrote a book on theology called The Body of Divinity in 1674. And Frank Moretto, a Brethren researcher, believed that Collier makes a reference to a pre-trib rapture but rejects the view. In other words, he mentions a pre-trib rapture view but rejects it, indicating that it was around. And so he considered the idea of a pre-trib rapture, if the saints were raised with Christ when Christ appears, and this is prior to the fulfillment of the bulk of Revelation, it is pre-tribulational, explains Moretta. Whether anyone actually held to the pre-trib view, contemporary to Collier, but that someone probably did, or this was just an exercise of the mind, we cannot say. So if this is a pre-trib rapture statement, it was hardly recognized as such at the time. And it's true that Collier had a futurist view of Revelation, which was rare to non-existent in his day. And as Moretta says, Collier was clearly pre-tribulational. Even if this were a pre-trib statement, it had no impact, known impact at the time. Then you have a guy named John Askell, and he died in 1738, but he wrote a book in 1700 about the possibility of translation without seeing faith. I'm sorry, without seeing death. In fact, the entire title, you know how they had chapter-long titles back then? And the entire title is an argument proving that according to the covenant of eternal life revealed in the Scripture, man may be translated from hence into that eternal life without passing through death, although the human nature of Christ Himself could not thus be translated till He passed through death. That was it. I found a copy at Bodleian Library at Oxford. It's 87 pages long, and it was burned, as heresy. So it's good that they had at least one or two copies. The British Library did not have it, so there aren't many left. And he, as a result of writing this book, in fact, most of the book I've read it, is him talking about how he knows nobody's going to believe it, but he's got to say it anyway. You know, he knew, I know I'm going to get in trouble, but I got to, you know, my conscience, you know, all this kind of stuff. And as a result of writing the book, Askew was removed from the Irish Parliament in 1703 and from the English Parliament in 1707. His book was examined, pronounced blasphemous, and had been burnt by order of the House without having been heard in its defense. He spent his last 30 years in prison because of his book on the rapture. He lived to be 100 years old, by the way. He's more like Methuselah than Enoch, it seems to me. So this kind of environment would tend to throw cold water on anyone desiring to make known their thoughts on the rapture. Now, Margin Edwards is a guy, and he's got a very developed view of the pre-trib rapture system, even approaching dispensationalism. And Margin Edwards was a Welshman, a Baptist, who lived from 1722 to 1795. And he was born about 25 miles north of Cardish Wells, and likely heard George Whitfield preach as a young student at the academy he went to in Wells. And he was founder of the Ivy League school, Brown University. He immigrated eventually to the United States and graduated from Bristol Baptist College or Bristol Academy in Bristol, England in 1744. He served several small Baptist congregations in England for 7 years before moving to Cork, Ireland, where he pastored for 9 years, and then he immigrated in May of 1761 and became the pastor of the church in Philadelphia in the American colonies. That was the most important Baptist church at that time, the Baptist Church in Philadelphia. And he was recommended for the position by the hyper-Calvinist John Gill. So he was a hyper-Calvinist, most likely, as many of the early Baptists in America were. After the Revolutionary War, he was known as the only Baptist clergy of Tory persuasion. So we should hear a little hiss and boo from the crowd at this point. Edwards became an educator and premier Baptist historian of the day. In fact, he's considered the father of American Baptist history. And he was awarded an honorary Master of Arts degree in 1762 by the College of Philadelphia. His major work was Materials Toward a History of the Baptist. And Edwards co-founded, as I said, the first Baptist college in the colonies, Rhode Island College, which we know today as Brown University of the Ivy League. He wrote a book on how to raise money for universities. I'm sure Mike is going to be interested in going and reading that book, yes. As was typical of the early American colonies, Edward experienced significant tragedy in his life. He outlived two wives and most of his children During a dark period in his life, he ceased attending church, took to drink, and was excommunicated from his church. Not a very good Baptist, I tell you that. After making repeated efforts to be restored, he was received into the church on October 6, 1788, and thereafter lived an exemplary life, which was another 8 years. Baptist historian Robert Torbett describes Edwards as a man of, quote, versatility, being both a capable leader for many years and a historian of some importance. In temperament, he was eccentric and choleric. With all of his varied gifts, he was always evangelistic in spirit. Another historian says of Edwards, scholarly, laborious, warm-hearted, eccentric, choleric, Morgan Edwards, one of the most interesting of the early Baptist ministers of our country, and one of those most deserving of honor. His very faults had a leaning toward the virtuous side, you know, I guess like drinking. And in good works, he was exceeded by none of his day, if indeed by any of any day. He was an able preacher, a good man, but not always an easy man to get on with. Edwards first wrote about his preacher beliefs in 1742. That's 85 years before Darby. 1742, as a student at Bristol College in order to fulfill an assignment his first year. He says, quote, I will do my most possible in the attempt will work by a rule you, apparently writing to his professor, often recommend, that is, to take the scriptures in a literal sense except when that leads to contradiction and absurdity. Very able men have already handled the subject in a mystical or allegorical or spiritual way. And so he's writing this his first year as a paper, and his work was first written in Latin during his student days in 1742. So years later, when it was published in 1788 out of Philadelphia, it was translated into English verbatim, thus reflecting his thoughts from 1742. So I found a copy at the Library of Congress and made a photocopy, and we have his entire book, which is only like 50-something pages, on our website if you want to read it. And we've modernized the spelling. Historian John Moore, quoting from Reverend William Rogers' sermon on Edwards' funeral, said, there was nothing uncommon in Mr. Edwards' person, but he possessed an original genius. So I included that quote to show that he was an original thinker. You know, he was different from the others. And this was an original thinker. Edwards apparently saw his views flowing from a literal reading of the Bible. Also, like Darby, Edwards developed these views early in life. And Edwards was between the ages of 20 to 22, while Darby was about 27 years old. Both men held their views throughout their lives. Almost a century before Darby developed and popularized a view of the second coming of Christ, known as pre-tribulationism, I just added for general reading. I'm going to skip over that. Edwards saw a distinct rapture 3.5 years before the start of the millennium. He taught the following about the rapture. Quote, the distance between the first and second resurrection will be somewhat more than 1,000 years. I say somewhat more because the dead saints will be raised and the living changed at Christ appearing in the air. And he quotes 1 Thessalonians 4:17. And this will be about 3.5 years before the millennium, as we shall see hereafter. He talks about it later in his book. But will he and they abide in the air all that time? In other words, will they hover up? By the way, as I'm going to show you tomorrow, that was a common view held all the way back to Joseph Meade, that they would hover for a period of time in the air. No, they will ascend to paradise. See, they're going to go into one of the mansions of the Father's house, John 14:2. There's dispensational pre-trib logic there. And disappear during the foresaid period of time. The design of this retreat and disappearing will be to judge the risen and changed saints. So he even throws the bema in during that time. And for now, the time will come that judgment must begin and that we will it'll begin at the house of God, unquote. So Edward makes three key points that are consistent with modern pre-tribulationalism. First, he clearly separates the rapture and the second coming by an interval of 3.5 years. Second, he uses modern pre-trib verses and to describe the rapture and support his view. And third, he believed the judgment seat of Christ for believers will occur in heaven while the tribulation is raging on earth, as is common in the contemporary pre-tribulationalism. The main difference between modern pre-tribulationalism and Edwards is the time interval of 3.5 years between the rapture and the second coming instead of 7. So Edwards reiterates his pre-tribulational stance later when he says, quote, another event previous to the millennium will be the appearing of the Son of Man in the clouds, coming to raise the dead saints and change the living and to catch them up to himself and then withdraw with them as observed before. In other words, in that previous statement, the events will come to pass when Antichrist be arrived at Jerusalem in the conquest of the world and about 3.5 years before his killing the witnesses and assumption of the Godhead. And Edwards also says in another place, the last event and the event that will usher in the millennium will be the coming of Christ from paradise to earth with all the saints he had taken up thither about 3.5 years before to justify against the accuser of the brethren and to settle their future business and rewards. Millions and millions of saints will have been on earth from the days of the first of Adam to the coming of the second Adam, and all these will Christ bring with him. So he believed that all believers would be resurrected at that point, not just the church. The place where they will alight is the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. Now, I've looked at every library in England and the UK, and only in the Scottish Library did they have a copy of Morgan Edwards' book on the rapture. The reason I did that was to see if it could have been a source for Darby. And it's concluded that there is no way that it could have been a source or influence for Darby. But this is the only... He wrote all kinds of sermons that were handwritten and manuscripted, but only this book was published in 1788. 8 years before his death. So this means, and he went on a preaching tour when this book was released, so he obviously taught this in the colonies, but we're only just now hearing about it. So he must have taught it to some extent, and it just demonstrates how you can have a view like that taught, and then, yet it not be widely known.
You have just heard the Daily Chapel message from Baptist Bible Seminary in Clark Summit, Pennsylvania. We hope that this teaching is an encouragement to you and that you will listen frequently. You may copy and share this message without modification. This and other chapel messages can be found on our website at www.bbc.edu. If you would like further information about Baptist Bible College, Graduate School, and Seminary, please visit our website at www.bbc.edu or call us at 1-800-451-2287.